loading, I guess.
Hi, my name is Sarah Powell. I am a medical anthropologist, and I've been working for 6 years with Temple University's Center for Preparedness, Research, Education, and Practice. Most of my work in Philadelphia is very much on the ground, working with the Department of Behavioral Health and the Philadelphia planners through emergency management and so on around mental health outreach and trauma interventions, things like that. So I just wanted to briefly mention, you know, of course, trauma in the community. We often focus on individual interventions and individual trauma, but trauma does affect entire communities, not just in terms of cultural groups, but in terms of individual neighborhoods. So one of the goals that we're trying to do is, first of all, assess the feasibility of implementing all hazards trauma interventions into local events. And in local community health settings. And some of the objectives of what I'm going to talk about today just involve demonstrating the facilitators and barriers to doing this, identifying some lessons learned from the Philadelphia model thus far, and assessing the effectiveness of the model in building capacity for large-scale emergency response. So the background of kind of where we're headed with this is that any exposure to trauma, you know, can have behavioral health effects, of course. However, a lot of the focus in Philadelphia to date has been on looking at either large-scale disasters or of the actual victims of violence rather than the communities that are impacted by these incidents. So what we're doing is looking at how early interventions can reduce impact of exposure, not just for victims of an event, but also for the larger community. And can we deliver this in a timely manner? Community-based crisis response is most often focused on victims of violence, as I mentioned. And we're trying to see if we can use this emergency response model to help reach a wider range of needs. So when we talk about trauma interventions that would be used in an all-hazards disaster response, primarily psychological first aid, which is an intervention used in the first 48 hours following an event, it's a model that comes out of the National Center for PTSD. And one of the reasons why these models have been adopted as a national model is that it's considered to be culturally appropriate across cultures, appropriate across age and gender lines, and it's also the primary focus is that it does no harm. It's an incredibly safe intervention. Critical incident stress management has typically been used as an intervention for first responders. There has been some debate around CISM because of a misuse of it after the 9/11 incidents in New York, as that kind of initial 0 to 48 hour trauma intervention. That's not really the appropriate time frame to use the debriefing models within CISM. Crisis counseling program is the official FEMA model that's usually used following an event. That's a later intervention, so 48 hours up until 9 months or a year following an event. It depends on the funding of the program. And the National Organization for Victims Assistance, or NOVA, many people are trained in NOVA. That's really for victims of crime. And it's a little bit more focused on that specific victims of violence situation. So the Philadelphia model is a community response team. This is the official card for the team. And just to talk about it, this is focused on providing early intervention during community crises of different kinds. It's a bit of a new context for emergency response. In Philadelphia so far, typically they would have sent out mobile emergency teams out of the behavioral health system to deal with psychiatric emergencies. But there really wasn't any intervention used for local community traumas, such as shootings and rec centers and things like that. What we're trying to do here is create a scalable intervention that can be used both for those local community traumas as well as provide cross-training and the ability for these teams to respond to larger disaster events as well. One of the reasons why we do this is you can keep teams engaged. You're responding to that gap in the community. It's that scalable structure, and people who experience trauma on an individual level in terms of these violence situations really have the same sorts of symptoms as someone experiencing trauma in a larger disaster event. So using something like psychological first aid in the first 48 hours of an event, you're really getting the same, you're providing the same benefits. Because of course, one of the things we do with psychological first aid is try to mitigate the eventual onset of PTSD and other anxiety disorders down the road. People in the first 48 hours are showing what we would typically think as signs of PTSD, arousal, re-experiencing, avoidance, numbing, all those signs and symptoms that we talked about earlier, which in those first 48 hours are perfectly normal. So doing PTSD, one of the main focuses of PTSD is to reduce arousal, which that physiological effect all by itself can actually mitigate the eventual onset of anxiety disorders down the road. So we do take an all-hazards approach, and as I said, we're building capacity within these systems. The people who staff these voluntary teams come out of the mental health MHMR provider network under the Department of Behavioral Health in Philadelphia. So they're made up of all level of mental health professionals within the system. One of the reasons for that is, one of the things we found out following a lot of the natural disasters and different events in domestically, is that we don't really need mental health professionals to do trauma interventions like this. You don't, in fact, paraprofessionals are often preferable for delivering trauma interventions like psychological first aid, because this is not a therapy. It's much more about compassionate presence and validating people's experiences and things like this. And it's very important that people don't kind of fall into a therapy or a therapeutic model when they're delivering this. Because these interventions are for people experiencing normal reactions to an abnormal event. We're not trying to create change as a traditional mental health therapy model would do. We're trying to prevent change and get people back to their baseline functioning. So one of the benefits for the mental health system is that you're building a cadre of trained volunteers who are ready to respond to even a large-scale disaster. And within the planning system in Philadelphia, Philadelphia has made it known to their provider network that should something large scale happen, they're going to be depending on the provider network to respond. It's better to have people who are trained to deal with these kinds of events and trained in psychological first aid to be, to be the ones who can respond to that, rather than having, simply just that just-in-time training, which would be fine, but it's, of course, better to have people experienced in response. There's ongoing training, retraining. We have some fabulous trainings in psychological first aid and crisis counseling, grief counseling. Right now we're working with Steve Berkowitz, who's done a lot at the national level around children in trauma, and they're training the teams on the specific reactions of children to traumatic events and how that in different, age levels. Because we will be now working with the school district to also respond to the school district, not to psychiatric events, but to larger traumatic incidents, multiple suicides and things like that. So repeated exposure to outreach opportunities for the team members also builds confidence and skill development. And it also centralizes and coordinates citywide mental health response so that at the Department of Behavioral Health level, there's an understanding of the capacity within the city to be able to respond to these events. And formerly, people would volunteer through the Medical Reserve Corps, like a behavioral health component of the Medical Reserve Corps, but the Medical Reserve Corps is only called out for very large scale events. So the people who were under the behavioral health wing of that really didn't receive that repeated exposure and development of their skills. I should say that the agencies, there's roughly 44 mental health, mental retardation agencies within the DBH network. Of the agencies who have signed on to be part of this response team, they're ones who see that the mission fits in with their goals as a mental health provider. And you have to realize, too, that most mental MHMR providers are looking at that post, that treatment end rather than a preventative end. So getting them involved at the preventative end is something a little bit new for them, for the most part. But many of them are really at the community setting, and the ones who are the closest tied to their local communities are the ones most likely to become part of these teams because they see that as fitting in really well with their mission. There are other teams and team members who just are very much involved in local response and have responded to incidents in the past and see the value of that. There's definitely a funding issue because of the recent economic situation. DBH is not able to provide additional funding for people who adopt this program or to become part of this program. So one of the points for leveraging adoption would be to try to address the payment and funding issues, to be able, that's been really the biggest barrier to date, is that many of the agencies operate on a fee-for-service basis, so being able to provide volunteer time for people who work fee-for-service is very difficult because they're having to sort of pay them outside of the normal structure, and trying to figure out a way to make that work would really benefit everybody, especially the Department of Behavioral Health, who's trying to get this initiative underway. Well, it is underway, but to try to build momentum. And to build on those perceived benefits of the strengthened community relations. I mean, we brought together, we had a great symposium last year where we brought together the different teams. We've divided the teams up, by the way, into six different teams that overlap the six police divisions in the city. So there's community policing teams that also include officers who deal with victims' assistance, and we've been able to connect those local agencies with these community policing teams, along with the victims' assistance agencies and other nonprofits in the area who deal with specific issues, women who've experienced sexual assault and things like that. So in terms of the agencies who reach out to those parties. So bringing together those different groups by division was really wonderful, because a lot of times the police, community policing teams did not know about what kinds of services were even available in the mental health, and just providing that facilitation has been really wonderful. And we have a demonstrated need from the community and citywide level for this service. And we found that since we've been raising awareness, there's been increasing call for the services of the community response team, because when incidents like this happen, you'd have a community affected and no services really available for that, kind of situation. When someone gets shot in your community who's a community leader at a local recreation center and it's witnessed by a number of people, it has a ripple effect through the community, and people are very much upset by it, but traditionally there hasn't been anyone to sort of help with that situation. The challenges we've had to date are clearly identifying the kinds of events that CRT responds to and the events that they do not respond to. For the people who are requesting services, for the police who are making referrals, for emergency management, and so on. And we've been trying to create very clear lines around that, but it's a little bit tricky. We don't respond to domestic house fires, but yet if there's a large apartment fire with a lot of people displaced, that would be an appropriate CRT response. some of the other events, you know, incidents in public parks. Now that's a perfectly appropriate response for CRT. Last summer there was a graduation from a local high school in North Philadelphia, and in the middle, like right finishing the graduation, two individuals who were graduating seniors were shot, and in the melee after that, three other people were run over by cars. Now this was a very traumatic event for that community, but we had no points of contact to send teams to. I mean, you need to have a safe situation for teams to go and contact. And then after the graduation, people disperse. The school district, you know, is that's the end of the school year. The school district is no longer doing anything for the community. So we have these kinds of situations where it would be an appropriate response, but there's no real way to connect unless the community itself holds a town hall meeting or something like that. So we're hoping that as we raise awareness, we can try to facilitate responses to more nebulous events like that. Access to interpreters or cultural brokers is really important. I really believe that looking at the cultural appropriateness of interventions is always vital. I know that these interventions have been vetted as being culturally appropriate, but there's very, you know, you need to have a culturally competent response every time you're going into a situation. We trained a number of people who were from the Haitian community to do crisis counseling earlier this year because we were possibly, Philadelphia was possibly going to get a number of Haitian evacuees. obviously, it's incredibly important to have, you know, counselors who have an understanding and awareness, not only in language, but in cultural norms and just ways of interaction, communication, things like that. That didn't end up happening, but, you know, it's obviously vital across the board, and one of the challenges so far has been to make sure that we're very clear on what's going on and getting interpreters who are culturally competent or getting, you know, training team members so that they're culturally aware before we do any kind of an outreach. I mean, just something as simple as handing a West African individual a water bottle with your left hand, you're right off the bat starting off on the wrong foot. So being culturally competent is really critical, even for something as simple as this. Federal CCP Crisis Counseling Program guidelines provide some issues because of the way they basically, to date, do not fund or do not provide reimbursement for people within the mental health network to provide crisis counseling. So one of the things that they want you to do if there's an event is to train a large number of people who are not connected to the mental health network because it's, you know, some people who are not doing that as their regular job, which is fine, but getting, you know, that number of volunteers who have some knowledge of trauma and disaster response can be really difficult, especially in the immediate aftermath of an event. So I think there's been some moves underway to try to get FEMA to back down on that a little bit. Some of the lessons learned, right off the bat, mental health response to a disaster situation is almost always on the back burner. And Pennsylvania is not a state, it's a commonwealth. So things do not work from the top down, they work from the bottom up, which means that everything in emergency management and emergency management planning is implemented at the municipal level. Decisions are made absolutely on the very lowest level of government. First municipal, then county, then state. The best a state can do is make recommendations. And one of the things that the center that I'm the director of at Temple has really worked hard to do is facilitate communication between the state and the counties and try to help them do some of the things that they're meant to do. Now, this isn't usually without any additional funding. Of course, it really depends on the emergency manager and that particular agency in terms of adoption of any kind of mental health or any kind of disaster planning, I should say. So getting mental health into the fore of any kind of disaster response is tremendously challenging, actually. I think it is often in many states, but it certainly has been in Pennsylvania. And at this point, mental health has been brought into the needs assessment of every disaster response now, because the Office of Emergency Management in Philadelphia is right off the bat assessing whether or not there's a need for this mental health response. It creates awareness for the need, it creates a larger capacity for such response, and it brings mental health to the table for things like exercises and trainings, which even at the national level through the Homeland Security exercise protocols and guidelines, there are no mental health assessments, templates. There's really nothing that's looking at assessing the mental health needs of a situation or training people to be there, to be present at any kind of, you know, large-scale exercise. Very quickly, I know we're kind of running out of time here, but there was a recent incident that was kind of a perfect situation to test this model. I don't know if you heard about it, but there was a duck boat that was hit by a barge. So the duck boat is a tourist boat. There were a large number of people who were there from Hungary who were hit by the duck boat. It resulted in two deceased individuals who were under the age of 20. Very traumatic incident. The teams were deployed. We didn't have anyone who spoke Hungarian, but there were some interpreters who we were able to get. The individuals very much needed this sort of response. It was a perfect PFA situation. It was very well received. And, you know, Office of Emergency Management requested the reservist right away, so it was a very good example of the use of this team. They were able to respond within an hour to the event, and, you know, the kinds of challenges we have are things like credentialing, having the right ID, having site access. Even though they were requested by emergency management, the police, who was sort of vetting entrance into the assistance center, did not have knowledge of the CRT, and it was a little bit difficult to sort of create that awareness, but, you know, hopefully that'll be an ongoing process. So right off the bat, we do have a demonstrated need at the community and citywide level. It seems to be a very good fit with community mental health agencies, especially those who are funded in part by DBH. We hope that some of these benefits can be leveraged for you know, the increased adoption by other agencies. But we do need to address some structural issues. Funding remains a primary barrier at this point, and we do need to continue to evaluate the program as we need. We'll just stop there. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, speakers. Wonderful job. We have a few minutes. We have about 10 minutes for questions, if anybody would like to ask any of the speakers some questions.
Good. Just a comment. It seems that in the United States, we still have problems with the system. The system is a patchwork of fragmented fee-for-service arrangements dealing with mental health, individual and group issues, versus what you have in other countries where you have a public mental health system that deals with emergencies and so on and so forth. Then another comment about Philadelphia. There are big problems in terms of social class, social and economic class, and race. And I imagine that you have to be very, try to figure out how to mobilize and to integrate your teams racially. Also that they know how to speak. I'm not talking about other languages, Hungarian. I'm talking about Philadelphia peas, the language, the local neighborhood language in various areas, which are different.
Well, fortunately, we hit on two different things. One being that there are community-based agencies that are locally placed, that used to be local-based service units. They receive some funding from the government entity, and they're sort of very locally based. Their catchment areas are local to the agency. they have a much easier time with this than the agencies that are private that do have primarily fee-for-service, don't receive funding, and are spread out throughout the city or have specialized services. It's much more difficult for them, I think, than for those local community-based mental health groups. The community mental health is also very familiar with its catchment area and its community, so they're the right people to respond to local events because they already have that close connection with the local community. And in terms of, you know, different cultural groups or communities, they're a good responder because they already know how to respond to those groups in particular. But it's true. I mean, you need to be very aware of different cultural groups, even different neighborhoods and what their needs are. You know, the Cuban community is very, very different in terms of needs and culture than the Puerto Rican community and so on.
Yes, now my question goes to Dr. Linda Koch, who's talking about mental health services. From my experience of what I've understood is, global mental health has always been limited to psychosocial support, and I was wondering, what is the role of like neuropsychiatric aspects in some of the work that you do? And it's been a little bit frustrating for some of us working in this area because, you know, there have been WHO studies have talked about the prevalence, the burden, the disability library study that have shown that mental disorder really should be a priority in low and middle income countries. But unfortunately, what we see is it's either integrated into HIV/AIDS prevention work or it's psychosocial work. And for some of us, we feel that that's not enough. I mean, it's a starting point. But I was just wondering, in your opinion, what do you think is going to move mental health priority to the top position in low and middle income countries? I was just, you know, I've been looking at like the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. Mental health is not an aspect, it's not, you know, part of the MDGs. We know that mental development can be achieved in those settings without mental health. So I'm just, you know, all these challenges really big issues. I'm thinking, what do you, in your view, in your opinion, what do you think is going to be the way forward to having?
That's an excellent, well said question, such a critical issue. And I think what we're really talking about is envisioning the continuum of care, right? So something like ours, which is more family-based prevention, should be at one end of a spectrum that moves all the way from more a higher level of care through social work, psychological services, psychiatric services, and also having, you know, inpatient facilities and testing and neurological attention, depending on the sorts of issues you're dealing with. And I think, you know, in global mental health, there's been a real failure yet to capture people's awareness of how critical these issues are. I mean, mental health problems are a leading contributor to disability globally, but we have a PR problem. We're not able yet to be appropriate advocates to get these issues on the global health agenda. Mental health is seen as like, oh yeah, and then there's mental health, instead of central to health and central to human functioning. And so we think about all these issues from infant mortality, you know, you think about postpartum depression, what that means for child survival, for goals that people are very much galvanized around, but we're failing to see the mental health part of that equation, that a very depressed mom may not be very attuned to the basic needs of her baby and able to meet those basic requirements, and those babies are more at risk. We know that from research. We know this in areas that are also important in terms of education and people's ability, you know, the MDGs around education, kids' abilities to be in school and pay attention and thrive, that all of these have mental health dimensions, but we've not been successful yet in really making these arguments in a fundamental way and getting mental health on the global health agenda appropriately. Now, what is exciting is that there is more of a movement underway now. I don't know if you've heard about the movement for global mental health, but if you Google that, you'll find Vikram Patel and the sort of leadership coming out of the London School of Hygiene. At the NIH, there's a very exciting new office of the director of the NIMH. So at Tom Insel's level, he's now appointed a global health coordinator, Pamela Collins, who's a fabulous psychiatrist, and she's getting off the ground one of the first initiatives at the NIH level around global mental health that's not just HIV. And that's been the problem. I mean, even for people like myself, you can get funding for global mental health in HIV, but if you want to do things like I also work on just general issues related to refugee displacement and conflict. You can do that domestically, but to get funding for that in, internationally is nearly impossible, especially in the sort of NIH paradigm. But with Pamela Collins' leadership, they've now issued these new, there's the RFA out right now for these hubs, these global mental health, the U19 hubs, to build capacity, and they're meant to build capacity in services development and also in research. And that's the big issue. I mean, I work a great deal in Sierra Leone. I've been working in Sierra Leone, West Africa since 2002, as well as just work in Rwanda. I've worked in Uganda, I worked in Ethiopia. And to just see how we're failing to even create a pipeline of bringing up people from low and middle income countries into the discipline. And in Sierra Leone, you know, there's one psychiatrist, you know, he's not the most engaging, warm person, and he's scared off anyone who wants to study mental health, and there's no one coming up behind him. And we've, you know, the WHO leadership and others, we've just sort of let that go, and it's been ignored, and Sierra Leone has, you know, very little in the way of a mental health system whatsoever, although they suffered a 10-year civil war and have tremendous population level global, you know, burden of mental health problems due to that. Another exciting initiative beyond the NIMH initiative is, I don't know if you've seen that report on mental health and the MDGs, but this was recently released by the WHO, so it's a fabulous tool for advocacy. When I was just in Sierra Leone like a week and a half ago, and the one thing I learned was that through leadership there, they've gotten mental health on the formulary at the district hospital level. But now the issue is the district health officers make decisions about where they put their budget. So mental health is one of the basic standard package of care items they can select to put towards their budgets. But they have to know about it. They have to see the links that Sierra Leone has one of the highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality. They have to see why mental health is important to achieving those goals too, as well as a part of overall health. And so we need these tools. We need, you know, to be able to put these arguments into, you know, simple, convincing steps. And I think people think mental health is complicated, the evidence base, well, it's sort of squishy, so we don't really know what to do, it's not like just giving a pill all the time, and you know, without a health system to build on, people are a little afraid. But I think we're in a much better place now if we start thinking about co-locating mental health services with other systems of care, so primary health care, education, getting more education out there about the relevance of mental health to overall health. And information about evidence-based treatments, that there is a great deal of an evidence base that we still need to test and adapt and understand more in low and middle income countries, but there's potential. And I think the field is in an exciting place, and I think that move by the NIH to have this U19 mechanism and things like that are sort of a sign of a sea change, and same with that WHO report for the first time that they've acknowledged that. So I think, you know, I'm excited that you're excited about it, and I think anyone in this room who's excited about it, you need to do your part.
Yeah.
And that's right.
I work with Pamela at NIH.
Yes.
We've been, you know, working on some of those issues. But I think the biggest challenge we've had is some sort of at the macro level. Most countries don't even have a mental health policy.
Nope.
In low and middle income countries. So it makes it extremely difficult.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, what we do. But yeah, those changes.
But you get out there and you talk to people, like, and I go and talk to those people in Sierra Leone, you can make the arguments, but that needs to be happening at every one of those countries, and it shouldn't be me. You know, it needs to be coming from people in that country. And because we're not developing the pipeline and bringing people up with that awareness, skill, and, you know, ability to translate the information, I think that's where we have to put a lot of energy, too.
You may want to start with the African Psychiatric Association.
Mm-hmm.
They have meetings, they are familiar with some of these issues, and they've been dealing with it for the last 50 years.
Sure, and there's a long history of amazing psychiatry in Africa, and, you know, at one time before the war, Sierra Leone was the Athens of West Africa, you know, people were going there for training. And so getting those things back up and running and those systems capacitated, I think that's really important investment.
Thank you.
One more question? Yep.
Rwanda, so what you were seeing with the community advisory board, you were saying about it, and how it's going to impact your intervention, which is your prevention.
Yeah, it's definitely a big issue, and it's one that, you know, there are other ancillary services, you know, so Partners in Health is doing a number of things. They don't really have a substance disorder treatment program, mm-hmm. but there is treatment for depression and other disorders that we know are often comorbid. And, you know, I think, again, this is something that requires a multi-level community response. This is why it's important to have community leaders and people like that involved, because there's a lot of sort of moonshine alcohol production going on at the community level. So it's also just dealing with the availability of it and people using that to cope rather than having other skills. So I still, this is a big area that needs a lot more attention that we're aware of, but you know, we're sort of doing that in partnership with the services provided there.
Thank you, everybody. If you have additional questions, you can seek out the speakers.